The following is an encore episode of Hour 1 of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy.
Could be Christmas every day, and I really do hope that it is not too early to wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas. No, we have not lost our minds here at Archangel Radio. Instead, we are responding to the sighting of a shoal of Santa figures swimming off the coast of Alabama. Yes, wait around for that. In a few moments, I will be joined by somebody who's going to explain this mystery. We will be talking to those Santas in the next segment. Now, our guest today is the author Kieran Troy, who is a pilgrimage guide. And for many years, 25 in fact, has been guiding pilgrims all over Europe and the Holy Land. And he's just published a fascinating memoir of his travels. He joins us in the second segment. So if you have any questions on pilgrimages, especially to Europe and the Holy Land, then feel free to call us on 888-928-0881 or text me and I will put your questions to Kieran on 251-928-2111. Now, today is the March for Life in Mobile, Alabama, and that march is beginning, I think, at around 9:45 a.m. in downtown Mobile. Now, fear not, if you can't get to the march, we are determined to bring the March for Life to you. So we are dispatching at no extra cost our intrepid reporter, Rhys Hodges, who will be hot-footing it from the studio this morning over to Cathedral Square to bring the march to you. So that's coming up in the final segment, and we'll see how that goes. An on-the-spot live report from the March for Life down in Mobile. Now, before that, of course, we will be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you can be part of that. That starts at the top of the hour, and the same numbers apply. 251-928-2111 if you want to text in a prayer request, or call in. Why not call in and speak to me on 888-928-0881. But before all that good stuff, what was going on at Gulf Shores earlier this month? Was there really a sea full of Santas swimming around? Well, to help me understand what happened, I'm delighted to say that we have tracked down one of those swimming Santas, Santa Jeff, and I hope he's on the line to me now. Santa Jeff, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Why, thank you. Yes, we were out on the beach this last weekend. And we had a great time down here in Gulf Shores.
So, Santa Jeff, talk me through what this event is, who organized it, what's it all about? Why are Santas swimming around the Gulf in January?
Well, it started out, we're the Cotton State Santas. We were organized in 2012. We're a chapter of the International Brotherhood of Real Bearded Santas. And we all get together every other month to fellowship and keep the spirit of Christmas alive and discuss how we do our thing, you know. And about 5 years ago, Chuck Ellis, one of our Santas, wanted to start doing a polar plunge and maybe start raising money for charity, but we haven't quite gotten that far yet. So we've been doing these polar plunges for 5 years now. And those of us that are having a good time, we get down here to the Gulf and we just jump in the water and have some fun.
Well, I have to say, Santa Jeff, the photographs looked great fun, especially for anybody who inadvertently was on the beach that day, because they would have seen this mass grouping of Santa Claus, and you all look so much like Santa Claus, heading towards the breaking waves. I mean, what was the sort of reaction of the local people?
The local people were just kind of in awe and stood back and watched. None of them ever came up to greet us, surprisingly. But I think it's because it was so cold and windy out there, we didn't have a whole lot of crowd this year.
I'm not surprised. January is not the sort of time when most people go skinny dipping, but never mind. Now, tell me, what is this International Brotherhood of Real Bearded Santas, IBRBS, I think it's entitled. How did that come about, and what's its purpose?
Its purpose is to teach and educate people who want to perform for Santa or as Santa, so that we can do the best job that we can and how we can handle different situations, like when we go to hospitals or deal with children that are just down on their luck type thing. And so there's sort of a school. There's a lot of schools for it, actually. There's at least 8 in the U.S., and there's even more over in the Germany, England, and several other places.
Wow. Now, listen, while we've been on air, Santa Jeff, I've had a question from a listener. You've obviously struck a nerve, because they're asking, how does one qualify to become a member of this elite group?
To qualify to be a member of this group, you have to have it in your heart, and you have to be willing to share the spirit of Christmas with children, and from there, we will teach and educate you from there. There's, as long as it's in your heart, if that's what you want to do, we're all about helping you.
Santa Jeff, we have had, just before Christmas, we had another Santa on the show who plies his trade in California. And I was absolutely amazed, because some of the things you're saying were exactly the things that he was saying, that a performing Santa is almost like a vocation, you know, and it's a vocation for the sick, for the lonely, especially for children, children in the hospitals. I mean, is that, you think, what's motivating these men who are the Santas that we meet in the various places? Is it a real desire to help people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of those, I'd almost say it's a calling, but it's not. It's just, once it's on your heart, you usually start out with, a church will ask you, oh, could you portray Santa for us this year? And then once you get that blessed feeling of doing it, you just want to do it all the time.
Well, talk to me about that. Tell me an occasion or the moment when you really realized that this was something that gave so much joy to other people.
Oh, I've been doing this 15 years. I would have to say, the autism children are what really get me going. Because as a sensory Santa, you have to take your time, you have to have some patience. But once they come around, the joy that they have, that you're sharing the spirit of Christmas with them, is what really just motivates me. I mean, sometimes it's really hard not to cry when you're performing with some of these children. And so it's also a good thing when we get to pray with them or pray for them, and just try to keep hope alive for them. And so that's the toughest part of the job.
But I guess one of the best parts of the job, Santa Jeff, is that in the showbiz world, your audience is always glad to see you, right?
I wish that were true.
Really? There's people not glad to see Santa?
They're always glad to see Santa from a distance, but a lot of times when the children get up close, that's when you get the child that it's too real for them, and they cry or they get scared and then don't want to come up. So it's kind of a win, give and take. It is really great. Most children are very excited to see Santa, and so it is very joyous. But there are many times when you have to work to get them to come close.
Now, for those of us that aren't Santas, we would have thought that the whole calling of being a Santa Claus is really something for the last few weeks of December. But it sounds to me like this is something which sort of is part of your life all year round.
Many of us are year-round Santas. We do several different kinds of events. There's Christmases in July. There's weddings. There's birthdays. And any time a charity calls up and says, you know, we need a Santa, they might not be here come Christmas, one of us usually accepts that calling and goes and does the visit.
What's the most unusual booking you've ever had to do in those 15 years?
Oh, let's see here. Most unusual booking I've had to do in 15 years. I don't know, because most of the time I'm at a mall, or I don't know that I've had anything really outstanding. I had one little girl that wouldn't come to me while I was wearing gloves because anytime she saw gloves, she recognized it as the doctors giving her shots and needles. And so when I took the gloves off, she came right on up and we had a great time. But it took us several visits, basically, to figure out that that's what it was. That it was the gloves is what scared her.
Nice. And you were able to help her with that.
I was able to help her with that. I took the gloves off, and within 2 minutes, she was sitting on my lap telling me what she wanted for Christmas and just enjoying the spirit of it.
That's nice. Now, press reports said that there was 57 of you down in Alabama swimming around the other day. When all these Santa Claus, professional Santa Claus, get together, I don't know what the plural is, Santa Claus I or whatever. what's the sort of professional stuff that you talk about? You know, is it like the how the costume's fitting? What are the sort of professional secrets that you talk to each other about?
Oh, it's mostly about where we can get our suits, how to clean our suits, how to take care of our hair and our beards. Many of us do bleach to be white during the season, and that requires a lot of cooling and effort. And then we have classes on proper posing and mostly just share our experiences with the others and the newer Santas. So that when they come to that, they're not blindsided, so to speak.
Yes.
Such as me, such as the child that, you know, wasn't aware of the gloves, but there's many others. How to deal with the child that says, you know, Uncle so-and-so needs to stop coming to my bed. I mean, we do come across some pretty horrible things in this world or tragic things. Yeah. Can you bring my mommy back? Can you bring my daddy back? It is tough. And most of the time we just pray for them, pray with them. And if we can find them help, we will.
Great. No, that sounds great. Now, I've had another question in, Santa Jeff. Somebody who's obviously thinking about being a Santa Claus is asking, do you have to look like Santa to join up? I'm not sure what the look of Santa is. I think we all kind of know. I mean, it's a rather large man with a white beard and white locks. But do you have many different shades of Santa in your battalion?
Oh, we have several. We have some that wear designer beards that don't have beards at all.
Mm-hmm.
They use the glue-on style. And then, for the most part, you don't have to look like Santa to be interested in wanting to be a Santa. If you remember Miracle on 34th Street, it was a short beard.
That's right.
Hair, no hair. There's so many different styles of how to portray Santa. And it's more in the personality that you develop than it is the look.
That's right.
It's in the heart. So it's how you project that spirit of Christmas that's going to make you successful or not successful.
Wonderful. Well, Santa Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I have one request to Santa, and that is, would Santa mind coming back closer to Christmas to tell us about all his activities around that time in Alabama?
Yes. We come around. We're on the third Saturday of every January. We host a meeting down here in Gulf Shores, and it's usually at the Sunliner Diner. On the third Saturday at 11 o'clock.
Okay.
And all are welcome.
Okay. And maybe we'll speak to you, Santa Jeff, closer to the big feast when you're very busy, but maybe we can have an on-location report of Santa somewhere in the Alabama area. That would be fun in December, maybe.
That would be wonderful. I'll be here at the Eastern Shore Center in Spanish Fort, Alabama, usually on the center stage by the big tree. If anybody does want to come out and ask questions and just visit.
That sounds great. Santa Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time from your reindeer and your various elf duties and coming on the show and telling us all about the secrets of Santa swimming in the sea.
You're very welcome, and I hope everybody has a blessed day.
Merry Christmas, Santa. Okay, that was Santa Jeff. Can you believe it? We have Santa Jeff on the phone in January. But obviously, what we're discovering about these Santas and the Santa we had on just prior to Christmas is that it's quite a serious vocation. It's a way in which they help children. That's its primary purpose. It's a way of celebrating Christmas and making or bringing joy to children. Now, as I said at the top of the show, today is the March for Life in Mobile, Alabama, and we are going to be there today. I'm hoping that our Reed is here today. Reed, are you with us today?
Actually, I just sent Reed down to the Mobile March for Life, down to Mobile, so we can kind of get, you know, find parking and get a head start and kind of get the lay of the land. So you're just stuck with me. I know. Sorry.
No, that's wonderful. Listen, Reed, I know you're listening as you're driving. Don't pick up your phone and call in. But when you land in Mobile, Alabama, we'd like to hear from you as to the lay of the land. Certainly at the top of the hour before the Divine Mercy, Reed, if you could just give us an update on your whereabouts. Hopefully you've been able to find some parking and got to the march and are ready for action.
Yeah. I've always enjoyed my time at the March for Life. I went to the one in D.C. back in 2014, mm-hmm. and I anchored it for EWTN, and it was snowing, and I'm jealous of I talked with Father Father Patrick Gilbreth the other day, and he said it was really nice weather. And I'm like, oh, you lucky! It was snowing and it was just freezing cold out in D.C. And I had several layers on, and you know, you can imagine trying to do interviews. And so I had to try to be as pumped up as and get the crowd, you know, pumped up so I could mm-hmm. not think about how cold it was. It was hard to get a word out. You know, you really have to stretch those jaw muscles, because as you know, it's really hard to speak when it's cold out there. So
absolutely. But tell me this, Mike, have you been to the Alabama, to the Mobile March for Life?
I have several times, and it's mm-hmm. it's an awe-inspiring event. It really is, and it's just great to see so many schools, you know, obviously the Catholic schools show up, and we have our non-denominational, our Protestant brothers and sisters in Christ show up for it, and they provide phenomenal music. I think this year Celebration Church is going to be performing. I think they're here in Fairhope, but it's just as uplifting, but you're with your brothers and sisters in Christ in the archdiocese. And so,
I guess, Mike, it's a truly ecumenical occasion. I mean, it's for everybody, it's pro-life, right?
It is. It's something that, well, pro-life unites us in Christ. You know, mm-hmm. God is for those in the womb. You know, before he knew us, he created us in the womb. So it's unchristian not to be. And so when you get thousands of people, or in this case, probably hundreds of people, you know, gathered in one location, there's that unity you feel. You see heaven, you see Christ in your brother and sister, regardless of their denomination. It's not about that. It's about uniting for a cause, for life. We stand for the dignity of life. That's why we do this, you know. We make the sign of cross of the cross. It's we're united, you know. We're saying we are with you, Christ. We are one with you, and it's such a beautiful thing to see, and it's so encouraging because, Kevin, you know, you see these high school students, whether it's you know a non-denominational church that comes or you know, obviously the Catholic schools come, but to know that there is hope. When you see these teenagers standing for life, they get it. That's what it's about. Mm-hmm. They get it, and there's hope for the future. That Jeremiah 29:11, that comes alive. That verse comes alive when you're out there and you're standing out there and praising God and worship and standing for life. That's what it's about.
Absolutely. Well, listen, if you're listening to us today, you can still bring us to the March for Life. You know, there's smartphones and headsets and headphones and all sorts of wonderful stuff that you can take us with you on this march. We're very happy to be brought there with you. So when we come back, we're going to be discussing pilgrimages. Stick around for that. Any questions on pilgrimages, get them ready for Kieran Troy. Coming up next here on Archangel Radio.
In the meadow we can build a snowman and pretend that he is Parson Brown. He'll say, are you married? We'll say, no, man, but you can do the job when you're in town.
Trees are such a valuable part of the landscape. Are you concerned about the health of your trees? Our expert arborists are familiar with all sorts of pest problems that affect trees. Insect, fungal, bacterial, even abiotic disorders like lightning or the various problems caused by humans. Schedule a professional consultation with a certified arborist that truly cares for your trees and understands how they function. Chris Francis Tree Care. For Tree. F-O-R-T-R-E-E.
When your heating or cooling system bites the dust, you're in trouble. It's getting too uncomfortable outside and inside to put off replacing it any longer. So let Farnell Heating and Air help. When you replace your old unit with a new system, you'll pay a whole lot less on monthly utility bills. So call Farnell Heating and Air at 251-471-2674 for a quick, easy replacement. That's 474-2674 or online at farnellac.com.
We all have kind of been going through the motions, and I think this is an opportunity to say, what does it really mean to be Catholic? What does it mean to be Catholic in a time of crisis in which things are not going so well for the church and for society? And I think that allows us to step back and say, what is fundamental to our faith? Fundamental to our faith is obviously the sacrament. Fundamental to our faith is community. What can we do to build that up? Rethink it all, and in a sense, like you said, start over.
LA Catholic Morning, weekdays at 7 a.m. on Archangel Radio.
Welcome back to the Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Now, just last year, I was intrigued by an article I came across in National Geographic, and it was asking the question, could pilgrimages be the next post-pandemic trend in terms of travel? It was pointing out that pilgrimages were already popular with solo travelers and non-religious travelers, but that pilgrim routes were offering travelers something more than just a package holiday. They were also offering a chance to find inner peace and to reconnect with a world post-COVID. Well, pilgrimages are nothing new to those of us who are believers. And many of us have been on pilgrimages at one point or another, and some of them have been very edifying. Some of them have just been rather amusing for all sorts of other reasons. And I was delighted to come across a recently published memoir from Ignatius Press called In the Stars, The Glory of His Eyes, Tales of an Irish Tour Guide in Rome. Its author, Kieran Troy, lives in a quiet part of rural Ireland, which he probably needs to, because the last 25 years he's been leading pilgrimages with his wife all around Catholic shrines all over Europe and beyond, primarily, however, to Rome. So I thought it'd be interesting to pick Kieran's brains about pilgrimage in the upcoming year. And I'm hoping that Kieran joins me down the line this morning. Kieran, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, 25 years as a pilgrimage tour guide, you must have seen it all.
Yes, Kevin. I suppose I started, you know, as a junior courier in Lourdes, and then I began working in Rome. And around the year 2000, Laura and I met up, we got married, and we started our own company. So, yeah, we've done, I would say, about 400 or 500 pilgrimages at this stage. We've met all sorts of people. You know, we've had cardinals and archbishops and bishops. We've had saints and sinners, everybody you can imagine on these trips with us. And we visited some great places. Many of them would be kind of obscure, I think, that wouldn't be well known outside maybe of Italy. but still very holy places and some great experiences we've had.
Mm-hmm. Now, for anybody who's read Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, we'll know that in medieval times, certainly the pilgrims were a rum bunch. I mean, as you said, they were saints and sinners, and that was just the clergy, probably. I mean, have you found, though, Kieran, in all seriousness, that pilgrimage is, it's not just a holiday, right? It's not just a vacation for somebody, but it's a journey with perhaps an unexpected ending for some people. Have you found that?
Yes, we found that. I suppose that's the reason I wrote the book, is that, you know, I usually travel with the pilgrims, and my wife, Laura, works in the office. And then when I come home and, you know, I'm sitting around the table with the kids at dinner and stuff, I often tell them the story of what's just happened. And it's great for me because these occasions, I actually remember some of the blessings we've had on the trip, you know. And then I began to write them down, and eventually, you know, it found its way into the book. Could I tell you one of the stories, Kevin, just to give you a kind
of
idea?
Just before we get there, Kieran, because we're going to come to the stories, and I've had a quick look at your book this morning, and it's got some really good tales. So I'm looking forward to asking you about those. But I'm kind of curious as to how you got into being a pilgrim guide. I mean, how did it come about that you ended up guiding pilgrimage?
Yeah, no, it's kind of just happened by chance that in 1997, there was a beatification in Rome of an Irishman called Edmund Ignatius Rice. He was founder of the Presentation Brothers Order, you know, a great teaching order. And now there was a lot of people going to Italy or going to Rome from Ireland. And there was a sister, a nun in County Kilkenny called Sister Teresa. She was looking for young people to accompany these groups and just to help out, basically. So I knew a priest who was traveling. He got me involved, and I traveled with a coach load, and we did all over the country. You know, we were up and down. We did Rome for the beatification, and then we went to Venice and down to Padre Pio in San Giovanni Rotondo and all those kind of places. And I really enjoyed it. And that was in 1997. But on the strength of that, this company in Dublin called Pilgrimage Abroad gave me a job the following summer. And then from there, I began working in Lourdes, and it just went on. It went on from there. Then in 2000, Laura and I got married, and we decided we would open our own company. And we started very small. I continued teaching English in Rome, and Laura had a job. And the first year, we did just a few groups, and the next year we did 10, and then 15, and then 20. It kind of exploded from there. We're talking about the last years of the papacy of John Paul II and the years of Benedict, the first few years. Now, because of the funeral of John Paul and all, and an awful lot of people wanted to visit his tomb in Rome, there was an awful lot of parish pilgrimages from Ireland going to Rome in those years. So basically, we kind of rode on the crest of that wave. And I say often, and it's true, that John Paul II paid for our mortgage because we just did so much work in those years. And it was people who wanted to see the tomb of John Paul in Rome. And
absolutely, Kieran, you're speaking to the man who was dragged to his funeral and is lying in state by his wife. And I was amazed at the crowds. We've got a question for you, Kieran, already from one of the listeners. And maybe it's somebody who's just wanting a little bit of clarification because we're broadcasting 1410 AM, 94.5 FM across southern Alabama. And the question is, what is a pilgrimage? Well, how do we define a pilgrimage? So maybe for somebody who's not a Catholic or not religious, who's listening, who's wondering, hey, what is this pilgrimage? How would you explain it to them, Kieran?
That is a great question, and it's a very deep question, you know, and you could answer it on all kinds of levels. But basically, when you go on pilgrimage, there's always a destination. You know, you're not just going, say, to a seaside resort and you're going to have a few prayer meetings. Or there's always a significant place that you're going to visit. So, for example, in Rome, it's going to be the tombs of Peter and Paul, the catacombs where the early Christians were buried and which has the oldest Christian artwork. Or it could be something like the tomb of a modern saint like Padre Pio. So the idea of a pilgrimage is always to visit a holy place and to venerate that place. But it's not just, you know, maybe for non-Catholics, it might seem a little bit strange, and they might wonder if it's biblical or whatever. But it's, in fact, it's very much tied up with the incarnation of Jesus. You know, Jesus became flesh and came to live among us, and we can find our way to Christ through these material things that have been sanctified by the grace of God. So when you go on pilgrimage, it's always visiting that holy place, and there's going to be all the prayers and prayer exercises. But it's a bit like, you know, it's like for the soul what you do for the body when you go to a health farm. You know, when you go mm-hmm. on pilgrimage, it's like a health farm for the soul. It's a time just to get away. It's not quite like a retreat. You know, a retreat is always often involves silence and recollection in a different kind of way. But it's an encounter with holy things, and you do it near. You can do it as an individual, certainly, but when you do it as a group, I think there's a lot of benefits, because when you do it as a group, you have the masses and you have the liturgies and the talks from the spiritual director and everything, and it can become a great time of spiritual renewal. So I would say, what's a pilgrimage? It's really it's oriented towards spiritual renewal through visiting these holy places associated with saints. Often they're associated with Christ. So the primary place of pilgrimage, of course, is the Holy Land. Now, it's often difficult to get to the Holy Land for political reasons and other reasons. And when we go to Italy, for example, it's kind of second best in a way, but it's not too far behind, because we're meeting people like Peter and Paul who directly encountered Christ. And, you know, it's a great time for renewal, Kevin. I'm sure you've experienced that yourself.
Well, absolutely. And just to let our audience know, you're listening to Kieran Troy, who is a pilgrimage guide of many years standing and has just published his memoir with Ignatius Press, In the Stars, The Glory of His Eyes, Tales of an Irish Tour Guide in Rome. You're making me wonder, actually, as I'm listening to you, Kieran, about it almost feels like being a pilgrimage guide, a person who helps and sort of shepherds the pilgrims around these holy places. It's a kind of a vocation, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that it can be, certainly. I mean, look, I know a lot of people who do the job that I'm doing in Italy, because we meet them. I meet them in the airports. I meet them in the hotels and everything. Some of them are not practicing Catholics, which is a pity, I think. They can still do a reasonably good job because they know the information and all. But I think that if you're practicing, or if you're interested in the faith, it can become a vocation, even if it doesn't seem like one in the beginning. I think that pilgrimages have done me a lot of good. When I began 20 years ago, I think, obviously, long way to go yet, but I think I was more egocentric and materialistic and everything. But just by going on these pilgrimages, encountering all of these great homilies and great people I've met along the way, and spending time in holy places, you know, I think it has done me a lot of good. And then, like you say, it's a vocation. So I have the privilege of speaking in front of people before we enter places like the Tomb of St. Peter in Rome. So, mm-hmm. you know, if I do my job properly, then I am going to ask for the assistance of the Holy Spirit, and ask that the words I say will help people to, you know, have a deeply spiritual experience and be changed. Yes. So, you know, there is that element to it, certainly.
Indeed. I've known tour guides in my time. A good friend of mine was a tour guide, and I've actually done a bit of it myself in my time, Kieran. And the one thing I didn't reckon on is how exhausting it is being a tour guide. Do you know what I mean?
It is. It's exhausting. It's exhausting, even if you're doing nothing. You know, my brothers, one of them is a farmer and the other is a truck driver, and they sometimes say to me, you know, do you really call that a job? You're sitting in front of a coach driving around Italy. You're eating dinners in 4-star hotels, you know. So obviously there is an element of enjoyment and traveling, and, you know, it's a great job and I love it, but it is tiring, and it's demanding. And if you've got a group of, usually it's a group of 55 people behind you who are depending on you, it's a lot of responsibility as well. Mm-hmm. But I mean, not complaining or anything, but there is that element of, and then very long days, of course, because, say, for example, if you're going to have Mass in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, you're going to have to be up at 5 a.m. to get to the hotel and get the group over through the metal detectors. And then that day is not going to finish until 11 p.m. that night. So days are long, and you do have to really look after your group there. A lot of our pilgrims are sometimes elderly people or retired people, so they do need care. And you can't just abandon them or disappear. You have to be there virtually all the time.
And even in the middle of the night, this tour guide friend of mine, Kieran, used to get, phone calls in the middle of the night. Something wasn't working, something.
Yes, that happens a lot.
You're listening to Kieran Troy, who is a pilgrimage guide extraordinaire, and he's just published a memoir with Ignatius Press. If you've any questions for Kieran about pilgrimages or any stories you'd like to share, then do feel free to call us on 888-928-0881 or text us on 251-928-2111. When we come back, we're going to have some stories of the 25 years that Kieran has been at work, and I'm sure some of them are going to be very, very interesting. Stick around on Archangel Radio.
On our way home, we're on our way home, we're going home.
The mission of campus ministry at Spring Hill College is to foster a culture of Christian faith by promoting the spiritual life of students, faculty, and staff. Our students are engaged in our community through service learning at local schools and agencies, mission trips, and studying abroad at the SHC Italy Center. Rooted in our Catholic and Jesuit heritage, Spring Hill College strives to build a tight-knit community that is strong in faith and prepare students for success in the real world. Apply for free at shc.edu/apply.
Blessed Silas, Francis in February, Sunday, February 5th from 11:30 to 3. Fun for all ages, food, bingo, the Kids Zone, barbecue competition, and more. Tickets on sale at francisxsilas.org.
Monday on LA Catholic Morning, Dr. Megan Clark talks about her article on Gaudium et Spes. Luke Koppen has the Starting Seven News links of what's trending in the Vatican, and we'll talk with Stephen Barr from the Society of Catholic Scientists.
LA Catholic Morning, weekdays at 7 a.m. on Archangel Radio.
This is Father Victor Ingles, Vocation Director for the Archdiocese of Mobile, with a vocation consideration. For a young Catholic man to consider being a priest is the most normal thought he could possibly have. For the rest of the world, it may seem crazy, but for us, it's just part of being Catholic. Don't be afraid to consider a call to the priesthood. This has been a vocation consideration. I'm Father Victor Ingles, asking you to consider what vocation God has planned for you.
Started drinking beer on Saturday nights, sleeping in on Sunday mornings, missing Mass, and then it just became a pattern and continued. Without God, I don't know where I'd be right now. I feel like I'm whole again. I know the importance of the Eucharist. I know the importance of the sacraments that I didn't know at a young age. I follow God's will because my desire is to get to heaven. Our lives are rich and full by being members of the church.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
To the Turley Frequency, live and exclusive here on Archangel Radio, and I am in a fascinating discussion this morning about pilgrimages. Yes, those journeys that we've made to holy places around the world. And I'm speaking to Kieran Troy, who has been a pilgrimage guide for over 25 years and has published the fruit of that in his memoir called In the Stars, The Glory of His Eyes, Tales of an Irish Tour Guide in Rome, published just last year by Ignatius Press. Kieran, you were going to regale us with some of your stories, so the floor is yours. Tell us what was the strangest thing ever happened to you on a pilgrimage.
The strangest thing, gosh. Kevin, before I answer that, I just want to say something in case I don't get a chance later. The book has something of you in it, you know? You don't realize this because you wouldn't have never heard it before, but the last chapter is about John Paul II, and that chapter was inspired by an article you wrote in the National Catholic Register about the time of his canonization, possibly. You had told the story of John Paul in the context of the miracle on the Vistula, which was the defeat of, Lenin's Red Army by the Polish ramshackle army, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was inspired because when I read it, I then wrote this chapter on John Paul And almost like what you had done, I wrote kind of all of Polish history through the lens of the life of John Paul II, a little bit like what you had done in that article. So I've never spoken before, but I just wanted to tell you and to thank you for writing that article and for inspiring my last chapter, which I consider to be the most important chapter in the book there on John Paul II. Now, you asked me the question there about the strangest thing that ever happened. Gosh, Kevin, I wouldn't know where to start there. Some of the things, maybe, I'm not sure if I could mention them here because I might get into trouble. But, you know...
Well, just change the names to protect the guilty, Kieran, as they
say. Wait till I see.
Well, I tell you what, tell us about the most uplifting then. Tell us about somebody who came on your pilgrimage who wasn't a believer or was reluctant as a pilgrim sent by their mother or something, and their life was changed by it.
Yes. Wait till I see. Gosh, I'm just struggling now to come up with one that I could tell coherently. I'll tell you this story here, Ken, a little bit different from what you're asking. And in it, I suppose, maybe I had a little bit of a conversion myself. We had a group. This is not in the book, but it's similar to the kind of stuff that's in the book. We were going to Rome Airport after a busy week. It was a choir, very good choir from a parish here near Dublin. And we're on our way to the airport. We had dinner planned in a beautiful restaurant on Lake Albano. So we all sat down for dinner, and the waitress who knew me, because we were often there, came over and said, "What kind of group do you have today, Kieran?" I said, "It's a choir, Anita." And she said, would they be able to sing for us? And I was obviously edgy. I wanted to get out of there, have the meal, and get to the airport. But Anita kept insisting that we sing, and I was trying to make excuses for why we shouldn't sing. Now, at the table beside our group, there was a group of about 20 Italians, very well dressed, and my driver, Salvatore, who was sitting opposite me, kept saying, "Don't sing in front of those people. You're going to disturb their dinner, and Italians don't like to be disturbed while they're eating." And I was very, very nervous about singing this particular thing in front of the restaurant, but the waitress kept insisting. So eventually I went over to Giovanna, the group leader, and I said, "Giovanna, do you mind singing? The waitress wants you to sing here for us." And they got up and sang. But before getting up, I said, "I better go over here to this Italian group and just apologize to them because I'm going to disturb their meal." So I went over. Mm-hmm. And when I was walking over, they were very well dressed, you know. I saw that there was a little baby, all dressed in white. I said, "Oh, it must be a baptism." I said, "Good. We'll say we're dedicating the song to the baby. And that way, you know, everybody will be happy." So when I got over there, I said, "Look, we'd like to dedicate this little song to your baby. And I think it's a baptism." They said, no, it's not a baptism. It's this man here, Carlo. He's retiring from work. And this is his retirement dinner." So, you know, obviously I had to keep going. I said, "Okay, we'll dedicate our song to Carlo." I was very kind of a little bit uptight and everything. Our choir stood up. The Italians all stood up. Their half-eaten plates of fish left on the table in front of them. I was mortified, you know. And the choir sang this beautiful Ave Maria. And then they all sat down, and I sat down, glad it was over. And Carlo came over to me, okay. He was crying, tears rolling down his face. He said that we are part of a neocatechumenal group. I think you probably heard of the neocatechumens,
sure,
Kevin.
Sure,
they're founded by Kiko, prominent in Italian parishes, very dedicated and absolutely brilliant people, you know, very often. And he said, "Every time we do anything, we pray." He said, "When we came in here today, we dedicated my retirement to Our Lady. And just before sitting down to dinner, we said the Ave Maria." And then he said, "A choir that we have never met before, never heard of, comes over and says they want to dedicate a song to me, and they sing an Ave Maria." And he was so moved by it. He got me to record the description of what had just happened on his phone for his son, who is very ill at home, who wasn't able to attend. But I just want to tell you that story, Kevin, in that I think the person who was converted there was me, you know, that I'm often on these trips, you know, anxious and worried about flights and traffic jams and checking people in and getting people back home safely and stuff. And sometimes what I need to do really is just, you know, put my trust in the providence of God, because I think that's what happened there. And it was a good lesson for me that sometimes we think we're in control and we need to be running the show, but the show has been run by, you know, by higher powers who have a much better plan. Now, I never, you know, met Carlo again. We exchanged phone numbers and everything, never spoke to him afterwards, but I know that what had happened that day was a blessing for him, you know, and probably, you know, strengthened him and encouraged him and was consolation to him and everything. Of course, our choir sat down and ate their dessert, didn't even know what had happened. I did tell them on the coach afterwards, all right. But
it's a lovely story. But just as you're speaking there, Kieran, I'm kind of conscious that, because you're talking about the stress. I mean, it is stressful looking after people. It is stressful because you're in charge, as you said before. You know, you're responsible to get people from A to B and then back to B and A's. Safely, you know, that's your responsibility. So, I mean, is there a patron saint of tour guides?
A patron saint of tour guides? Gosh, there is a patron saint of pilgrims, and his name is Giuseppe Labre, Joseph Labre. He lived as a kind of a pilgrim himself, constantly on pilgrimage. He lived like a beggar, you know, going from one pilgrim site to another. His relics are very close to where my wife, Laura, lives in Rome. They're in a church on the Via Taranto, so we often visit his relics. He's certainly, and also St. Rocco, of course, is a patron of, but patron of tour guides, I'm not aware of one, Kevin, there may well be, but
Kieran, I'm wondering, why did you choose to write your memoir now? What was the catalyst for this book?
Well, some people think, you know, they say, oh, this is what you were doing during the pandemic. But in actual fact, I wrote it before the pandemic, and I think I submitted it to Ignatius just around that time in 2020 when the pandemic was starting. So the catalyst was this, Kevin, that I would come home, you know, from these pilgrimages, tell the kids the story, and other people here say, you should write that down. So I wrote them down eventually. Each one was kind of a separate story. I wasn't sure what to do with them, but then, you know, I'm a bit slow on the uptake, and then I realized, gosh, each one could stand as a chapter in a book. So eventually I put 9 of them together. And what happened then was that in 2019, a friend of mine had read one of the chapters and said, no, you really must get this published. So it was then coming up to Christmas 2019, I said to Laura, you know, I think I will send it to somebody. And I decided to send it to Joseph Pearce. I think you know who Joseph Pearce is, you know, great.
I certainly
Englishman.
Do, yes.
Great literary figure and brilliant guy and everything. I don't know him personally, but in January of 2020, I sent it to him and he was too busy. He said, sorry, I don't have time to read it. And I said, well, Joseph, when would you have time to read it? You know, it's very courteous. Very often people wouldn't even bother replying, but he said, if you send it to me, and he gave me a date that I should send it to him. And it was like February or so of 2020. And he read it and he said, I think it's worthy of publication. And he said, what do you want me to do with it? Do you want me to recommend it to a publishing house? And I said, yes, please. And then he sent it to Ignatius. So that's how it came to be written.
Bingo. Listen, I've got a question here that's just come in for you from a listener. And it's asking, what was the most craziest thing that ever happened to you on pilgrimage?
The craziest thing that ever happened on pilgrimage?
You have to define what crazy is, Kieran, in this context.
Yeah, okay.
It could be good, it could be not so good.
Yeah, well, I'd say the craziest thing possibly that ever happened was that for us as a company, it was back in 2005, we had a pilgrimage due to leave Ireland, and Alitalia, who used to fly that time from Ireland to Rome, decided to call a strike on the very day that our group was due to leave, you know. We were left in a terrible situation without flights and stuff. The easiest thing would have been to accept a refund and just call it all off, you know.
Absolutely.
But we took a gamble. We took a gamble, and that's why I think it was. And we we decided to buy alternative flights with Aer Lingus, who the Irish, you know, carrier. Mm-hmm. And we put it all in God's hands, really. It was an early experience for me and Laura of putting everything into God's hands. We just felt that the pilgrimage should go ahead. And we took the gamble, and it went ahead. And the following year, Alitalia returned all the money to us, even though we hadn't exactly fulfilled the terms that they were offering us in the beginning, which involved all kinds of complicated rearrangement of flights and stuff. So I think that there would be one of the most remarkable occurrences that happened to us. And also great, it was a great lesson for Laura and me on trusting God's providence and sometimes
Talk to me a little bit more about that, Kieran. In your 25 years of guiding pilgrimages and pilgrims, spiritually, what has it taught you?
Yeah, I think that it's a bit like that little story I told you there about Carlo in the restaurant in Rome, that that we should we shouldn't worry too much. Well, obviously, we have to do our job properly, and doing our job properly means studying and getting the best arrangements and making sure the hotel is up to scratch and doing all of that work as well as we can. But that at a certain point, and that we must leave it in God's hands. So Laura and I, before we do any pilgrimage now, we've been doing this for a good few years, but we do it fairly formally now. We say the rosary beforehand, and we say the rosary every day, but we say a particular rosary for this particular group, and we consecrate it into the hands of Our Lady. And once we do that, you know, it's actually a relief for us, because then we know that we've nothing to fear. And, you know, sometimes as soon as we do that, everything starts going wrong, you know. But then we realize that this is just, it's just a test. We just have to keep the faith and trust. And thank God, you know, we have been blessed, Kevin. We've done all of those pilgrimages there. And we've been so many times close to disaster, you know. Even this year, 2022, virtually every group of ours that left Dublin Airport, either the day before or the day after, there was a major problem, you know. Like, for example, one day there was the airport's computers broke down. All the flights were cancelled, even flights coming in from America. And we were supposed to have left on that day, but because of something that happened, we had actually moved our flight to the following day. And the following day, all the flights left on time. Now, look, it's not that by putting ourselves in the hands of Our Lady, we avoid heartache and delays and strikes. They do happen, and we are often sometimes left sitting in the airport for a few hours. But generally speaking, we have avoided, you know, the really major disasters. And thank God, all those thousands of people that have traveled with us have all come back to Ireland safely, and often, you know, uplifted and blessed through the pilgrimage, you know.
Tell me this, Kieran, we're running out of time. I've had another text about travel recommendations, but I'm just going to tweak it a little bit and ask you, of all the places you've been and all the places you know of, what is the sort of hidden gem that you would say people might overlook, they might not know about, but is really worth a pilgrimage?
Yes. So, wait, let's see. There's so many there I could say, but let me just pick one or two. Rome is where we specialize in. So, you know, in Rome, the principal pilgrimage places are the four major basilicas and the catacombs.
Sure.
But in Rome, there are some absolutely incredible churches. So, if somebody happens to be in Rome, if they cross the Tiber to Trastevere literally means across the Tiber, there are two magnificent churches over there. One is called San Benedetto in Piscinola, which is where the young Benedict, before leaving Rome and going down to Subiaco and founding the order, used to live. And that church was turned into, that house was turned into a church more than 1,000 years ago. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's small, it's intimate, it has beautiful works of art, and it's very ancient, very original. And just a stone's throw from there is the Basilica of St. Cecilia in Trastevere. Mm-hmm. And that has the tomb of the patroness of music, and it has mosaics from the 7th or 8th century, and frescoes. It's absolutely beautiful place and actually quite quiet. Then another place near St. Mary Major Basilica, St. Mary Major, very visited, but just literally around the corner is the church of Santa Prassede. Santa Prassede and her sister hosted St. Peter in Rome. So St. Peter in Rome, before he was executed, probably stayed in that building, which later became a church. And that, again, has magnificent early medieval mosaics. So I think when you visit places like that, you really are, more so maybe than in the basilicas, which have all been modernized and rebuilt in the 1500s and 1600s, if you go to these older places, you get in touch with more medieval Rome, and mm-hmm. you really feel the antiquity, you know, and
absolutely,
you really feel a connection with the early church, I think, when you go into these places.
I couldn't agree more with you, Kieran. Now, Kieran, we've run out of time, unfortunately. Tell people where they can get hold of the book and where they can also find out more about your pilgrimages.
Yeah, well, the place to get hold of the book is on the Ignatius website, ignatius.com. I think that's the best value and best place you're going to get it. It's yeah. also available on Amazon. Then, Kevin, I have done some of these interviews before. I generally don't give the name of our tour company. Okay. We're trying to keep business to a minimum because we're a little bit overrun at the moment.
Oh, wow. Well, that's good, Kieran. That's good news.
That's good. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's
thank
fair
you,
enough.
Kevin.
So thank you very much, Kieran. That was Kieran Troy, the author of In the Stars, The Glory of His Eyes, Tales of an Irish Tour Guide in Rome, published by Ignatius Press. And you can pick the volume up today at all the usual places. It sounds like a really interesting read. And I don't know about you, but listening to Kieran's various adventures, I never really thought about tour guides in that way. I have done a little bit of it myself in my time, and I just found it really exhausting. And going around showing people different things and talking about the history of different things. But it really is a vocation, and if you've got a group with you, it's a 24-hour vocation. Now, talking of vocations, when we come back, our vocation to pray is coming up with the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Join me after the break for that.
I've seen that road before.